Hi, Christian Yordanov here. I'm a functional health practitioner and author. My latest book is How to Actually Live Longer, Volume 1. If you haven't got yourself a copy, please check it out. It's really good information in terms of increasing your longevity, reducing stress, inflammation, and all those things that age us prematurely and contribute to disease and degeneration. Today, I'm going to talk to you about estrogen. It seems like a good topic to educate people on, especially women, obviously, because there's a lot of not just misinformation, but harmful misinformation out there. And with a lot of my female clients, I'm noticing estrogen-related issues, even though blood work or other hormone tests that we sometimes do, even though everything seems to be okay-ish, in terms of things are in the their sort of range, nothing is too high in terms of estrogen, there's still a lot of issues that are indicative of estrogen dominance. So the way we work is we try to balance that, or I suppose we try to remove the estrogenic burden, quote unquote, as much as we can, and balance it as much as possible. And generally things improve, things like PMS, irritability, stuff like that, that tends to improve over time as these hormones are a little bit better balanced. So just for your sake, please know, if you're listening to the podcast, if you're not on my website right now, look in your podcast player. You can open a web page where this episode will reside. And there I will have a chart of basically the steroid pathways towards estrogen, just to give you a bit of a visual so you can better picture what I'm talking about here. So I'm going to give you an overview of estrogen, and then we're going to talk, basically make it without too many technicalities. I'm just going to get into where can things quote unquote go wrong with estrogen, right? So I'll give you a minute if you want to open the link inside. Otherwise, you can go on a search engine and type in estrogen pathways. It will come up as well. If you need a visual, that is, right? So anyway, cholesterol, the evil cholesterol, right? That's going to give us all heart disease and everything. Cholesterol gets turned into pregnenolone. That's the steroid hormone precursor of all the steroid hormones, right? This process happens in the mitochondria. And if we have dysfunctional mitochondria, this process can already be impaired in a lot of people. And that what that can lead to is a lot of health issues, right? And a lot of toxins, alcohol, a lot of medical drugs, just certain lifestyle, sort of suboptimal lifestyle habits and stuff like that, they can impair the functioning of our mitochondria. So that is something that we always address with my clients in terms of reducing toxins, detoxification, eating clean, you know, mitochondrial support with vitamins, minerals, etc., nutrients. So anyway, pregnenolone, the steroid precursor, can become progesterone, okay? But it can also become DHEA, dehydroepiandrosterone. That can turn into an androgen called androstenedione, and that, via another enzyme, can become estrone, right? So there's four estrogens, main ones that have been identified. There could be more, but you have E1, E2, and E3. So estrone, E1, estradiol is E2, and estriol is E3, right? So E2, estradiol, that's the most potent estrogen, okay? That's made chiefly in the ovaries of a female. And estrone, that can be synthesized in our in other cells, including fat cells. So androstenedione can become estrone, but it can also become testosterone. This is why looking at the pathways is a little bit clearer. That's why I mentioned it. And testosterone can be aromatized by the aromatase enzyme into estradiol, so E2. So this estradiol, E2, and estrone, there's three pathways where these can be detoxified. Now, these have to be detoxified because too much estrogen, as you see in a minute, is not just carcinogenic, but it can lead to a lot of disease. So we have three pathways. You have the 2OH, 4OH, and 16OH. And generally, I won't get too nitty-gritty here. The 4OH pathway, if you're dominant in that pathway, that can cause issues where certain free radicals, quinones, and other things, can be genotoxic, which means they can damage the DNA and lead to carcinogenicity. Okay, so and then the 2OH and the 16OH pathways, they're actually better. But just what really we have to already understand is estrogen, we have multiple pathways of detoxifying it. And the fact that we are detoxifying it indicates that this hormone is toxic in greater quantities than are required, right? The mainstream medical establishment, or perhaps the pharmaceutical industry, that who in turn influence the mainstream medical establishment, they have labeled estrogen the female hormone, right? But it's not the female hormone. How do we know? And this is from a scientific paper that some of the stuff that I cite here is from a peer-reviewed paper, so I'm not sucking it out of my thumb. So this is citing that paper. Estrogens affect the growth, differentiation, and function of diverse target tissues, not only those involved in the reproductive processes, but tissues throughout the body. Estrogens play an important role in bone formation and maintenance, exert cardioprotective effects, and influence behavior and mood. So this is, again, the mainstream viewpoint that estrogen is the female hormone, but it has all of these other functions. And they're saying that it helps with bone formation and maintenance, and it's cardioprotective, neuroprotective. But and they're saying that it affects the growth, differentiation, and function of diverse target tissue. So it's actually, there's evidence that's not necessarily suppressed, but basically it's more like progesterone and the androgens like testosterone and DHT are actually the hormones of differentiation, whereas estrogen is more of a hormone of proliferation and growth. So it can stimulate the growth, but it's often undifferentiated growth. So something like a wound, it can stimulate the growth of tissue to heal that wound, which is here is the kind of the big clue. If all of our tissues can create estrogen with this aromatase enzyme, why do all of them need it if it's a female hormone? Why does a man and a woman have this capacity to create estrogen in all of their cells and tissues? It's because if they're injured or there's a site of injury, that hormone being able to create estrogen to stimulate growth and proliferation to rebuild and to support the rebuild and repair processes is essential. But here's the thing, its role there is perfectly fine, but the body knows that too much growth and proliferation, especially when it's undifferentiated, can lead to tumors and cancer. So this is why we have multiple ways of detoxifying estrogen in the liver. So the big reason why it's being marketed as the female hormone is so that it can be sold as a quote-unquote medication, right? Birth control being the biggest one. It's similar with serotonin. I'm going to do a podcast in the future about serotonin, which is not the happy chemical. This is, again, big pharma marketing it as the happy hormone so they can sell you drugs that increase serotonin. And they say it's low in depression, but there's studies coming out there saying that it's actually serotonin is actually high in depression, and it's also high in a lot of other disease states. So similar with estrogen, it's being marketed this way, and what they're doing is they're maiming and destroying the health of millions of women. They've been doing this for decades, and this is straight up criminal activity. I have clients that have been on birth control pills for a decade or more, sometimes for multiple decades, and it never ends well. So this is something we need to educate ourselves and protect ourselves, because nobody out there is going to protect us, right? So this is part of why I am doing episodes like this, so you can understand in a little bit more depth what the heck is going on with these things, right? So here's another interesting fact. So estrogen, as I mentioned earlier, it's synthesized from cholesterol in the ovaries in women in response to pituitary hormones. So the pituitary gland in the brain secretes certain hormones, you know, luteinizing hormone, follicle stimulating hormone, and so on. So the amount of estrogen you produce in the ovaries depends on the cycle and so on. But here's the thing. You're producing 70 micrograms per day up to 500 micrograms, right? Depending on where you are, what phase of the menstrual cycle you're in. So that is a tiny amount, 70 micrograms. So 500 micrograms, that is half a milligram. Now, in contrast, progesterone, a healthy woman will be premenopausal, will be producing something in the order of 30 milligrams of progesterone. So that is a difference of as much or at least 60 times more, right? And then if I do the math quickly, I'm not really good at math and stuff like that, but 30 milligrams, that is 30,000 micrograms divided by 70 micrograms. So that is 428 times more progesterone being produced in the day as opposed to estrogen. So point being is you need tiny amounts of it, tiny amounts of it, right? This is where the xenoestrogens from the environment, the plasticizers, and the phytoestrogens in a lot of plant foods can really mess with you. It's because you need so little estrogen in throughout the day that it's easy to get milligram quantities of these phytoestrogens through the diet, especially if it's heavily plant-based. Okay, so but here's another thing. This is the part where a lot of women I have to educate them when I work with them. So we sometimes do the Dutch hormone panel. It's Dutch stands for dried urine test for comprehensive hormones, and this is a collected home lab test where you just pee on a few strips of paper over the course of 24 hours, and then we can. The lab, you send it back to the lab, and we can check estrogens, androgens, cortisol, DHEA, metabolites of estrogen, certain organic acids. We can check for B12, vitamin B12 deficiency, dopamine. There's a marker for DNA damage or oxidative stress. So it's a really great test that can give us a picture of the hormonal metabolism on that specific day. So this is where we also have to factor in the fact that when we do blood work, we are testing the current, that minute, that second, what was the the hormone balance and whatever other things we're testing for in the blood, which is a snapshot in time. When we test something like when we do a Dutch test and you're peeing on the paper, you're excreting the urine, obviously. So we're seeing what you are excreting. So there's also the other not so minor portion of what is inside your tissues, in the cells themselves, in terms of estrogen, cortisol, androgens, testosterone, other, you know, all the other things. So that is a very difficult thing to assess. Excretory tests where we're checking excretion, like hair tests, for example. A lot of the minerals in the hair test or even the heavy metals, they're not necessarily going to indicate the body burden. So you could have a very low mercury level on a hair test. That doesn't mean you don't have a ton of mercury. It could just mean that you're not detoxifying mercury. You might not have no cadmium in the hair, but if we do stool test, we could have a lot of cadmium in the stool because that's usually the pathway of excretion of cadmium. So similarly, with hormone, like the urine tests for hormones and toxins and other stuff, we're seeing what you were excreting that day. So if your liver is quote unquote sluggish, which I'll explain in a few minutes what that means, if you're missing cofactors and nutrients required to detoxify estrogen, your body burden might be high, but the test might come up, everything might come in the middle of the range, and then you'll be like, oh, so my estrogen is fine. I don't have high estrogen. I don't have low estrogen. But here's the other thing. If your estrogen is low, it could be because you're not excreting it well. Not that your overall body burden of estrogen is low indeed, right? So we can't just look at a test. You know, some folks can order this test themselves, look at it and be like, oh, I'm totally fine. But this is where the clinical picture has to be built based on current issues, symptoms, history, diet, supplementation, you know, all the other bits and pieces. And then the lab work is kind of the cherry on top, and then we can really assess a person. So point being there is if you have symptoms of estrogen dominance, no amount of blood and urine testing is going to really be sufficient to just write you off as, oh no, you're fine, it's all in your head. You know what I mean? So we still have to do stuff, and I'll explain why and how things can go wrong on this side of things. But I just wanted to correct something that a lot of women come to me with, the sort of no fault of their own, that is, but they're coming with this sort of notion or idea that it's possible to be estrogen deficient, right? So we're menopausal women are being put on estrogen and synthetic progestogens, which are really, really bad. I would stay the hell away from both of those. But the estrogen thing, the reasoning behind the estrogen is because they're told that menopause and a lot of symptoms thereby are caused by an estrogen and progesterone deficiency, right? So here's where what I'd like to set straight for you. It is incredibly unlikely that you will ever be estrogen deficient. And if you go back to that chart that I was talking about earlier, as you can see, just to go back for a second, so estradiol, E2, that's made in the ovaries, okay? But estrone is made in our tissues. And we basically, especially fat cells, have the aromatase enzyme. Most cells in the body are able to create E1 or estrone from androstenedione, which is from DHEA, right? And DHEA is an adrenal hormone. So it's made in our adrenals that circulates, and then cells can pick it up, turn it to androstenedione, and then it can become estrone, right? So that estrone can become estradiol. So this is a lie designed to sell women estrogens and to make them sicker, so that they can then be a few years later can be treated for other things. This is, it's just as simple as that. So it's pretty sick. It's pretty disgusting. But that this is, once you understand this, you'll be like, you will start questioning a lot of things, right? I just to give you an example, I had one client. She was in her mid-60s, just past mid-60s. And she did her first liver flush, which I'll discuss in a few minutes, why that's important. She did her first liver flush, and then she felt bad. And her integrative practitioner had her on estrogen, progesterone, I think testosterone, and desiccated thyroid. So she felt horrible. So she stopped all of those things out of her own volition. She didn't even tell me. She only told me on our next call. And she felt the same. She felt like she felt normal, right? So what were those things really? Were they actually helping her if she felt better without them? But here's the question. Why did doing a liver flush and decongesting the liver suddenly make those things feel more potent, and so much that, you know, she was experiencing horrible symptoms from them? It's probably because they were being metabolized better or more actively, and they were exerting a stronger effect on the body, right? So it's just interesting how women are just being, you know, potentially naturopathic and integrative and sort of more functional docs are still putting women on estrogens, thinking that there is even such a thing as estrogen deficiency. It's kind of pretty crazy, but a lot of this brainwashing is very difficult to undo, because there's so much literature that supports this notion, right? But when they look at it, they're looking at blood levels. When I say it, I mean when they look at a menopausal woman, they're looking at blood levels of E2. That is how they're saying you have so the levels are much lower in a menopausal woman of estradiol, and they're saying you have an estrogen deficiency. But they're not really necessarily looking at E1 or estrone. They're not, and of course they're not doing histology or biopsy to actually check the tissue level of these estrogens. So pretty sickening that they're being put on more of this. This is a toxin. This is a known human carcinogen, estrogen, right? That you need in the microgram amounts, otherwise it becomes a problem. And all the other hormones, or a lot of the other hormones, are in the milligram quantities, so they're an order of magnitude more of them circulating. So it's a tiny, tiny amount. I think the only other hormones are the thyroid hormones that we need such minuscule amounts of. I think you make, I don't know, like 100 micrograms of the T4 thyroid hormone, so somewhere in that region. So that's the other one that's really powerful. But it's the body has a really good way of inactivating it if there's too much circulating of it, right? And generally, in most people, it's an issue of not enough being produced when it's an issue, that is, right? Anyway, that's a whole different topic for another day. So, as I mentioned already, estrogens are also produced by the aromatization of androgens in fat cells, skin, bone, and other tissues. After menopause, most endogenous estrogen is produced in the peripheral tissues by conversion of androstenedione, which is secreted by the adrenal cortex, to estrone. Like I mentioned already, if you have adrenals and they're working, you can make estrone, which can be turned into estradiol if needed. So you will never, almost never, be deficient in estrogen. This is a marketing ploy designed to sell more drugs to women. Now, as I continue here, in addition, this is again from that paper that there's no need to cite it. This is kind of commonly accepted information I'm sharing. I'm just kind of adding my own commentary as we go. In addition, some estrogen continues to be manufactured by aromatase, that's the enzyme, in body fat, and the ovaries continue to produce small amounts of the male hormone testosterone, which is converted to estradiol. The total estrogen produced after menopause, however, is far less than that produced during a woman's reproductive years. And this is, again, common scientific knowledge. Estrone and estradiol are biochemically interconvertible and yield the same family of estrogen metabolites. Okay, so that's not that important. Now, here's where it becomes a bit more applicable and practical. The liver uses various B vitamins to detoxify estrogen and excrete it where? In the bile. So the bile, it's not just there to help us digest fats. The bile is a pathway of excreting toxins. And as I've mentioned on other podcasts before, the bile that we produce, a lot of that is recirculated at the end of the small intestine. So that's a pathway for a lot of toxins to get back through enterohepatic circulation. That's not good. Now, what's interesting is that estrogen excess is known to produce cholestasis, which is a term that signifies diminished bile flow or stasis of bile. Okay. Naturopathic physicians often refer to this condition as a sluggish liver. So the diminished bile flow, the stasis of bile, right? They call it a sluggish liver. All of my clients, I recommend them to do liver flushes, multiple liver flushes, right? And invariably, the women that get the best results, the results that make the most progress, start sooner doing them and are more consistent in doing them. You need, because you can only do one per month. You can in practical sort of terms, with all the logistics involved, you can only do 10 to 13 in the course of a year. You can do 13 if you have all your ducks in a row and you plan it well and you're super committed. But I'm happy if they can even do 6 in the warmer months, because in the colder months, it's a little bit harder. The day of the flush and the next day is a bit harder because you don't eat as much and you feel cold, and it's not that fun. I've done it myself, so I know what it's like. And so at least getting 6 in the year for a couple of years is a great idea. But anyway, this is why I recommend the liver flushes so much, because estrogen. So what? Yeah, to go back a second. Women are at a much higher risk for gallstones, and this is the reason why. Estrogen excess is known to produce this cholestasis, which is the diminished bile flow. Having been pregnant is a risk factor for gallstones. Being female is a risk factor for gallstones. So women really benefit from this procedure. That's why I have a course on it. That's why my detox course, that's 13 hours long, has a 2-hour module on how to do it properly. That's why I'm always pushing women to do this, right? As much as you can, as many as you can in the year. Now, just to explain the sluggish liver term a little bit, it's not some woo bullshit. It reflects minimal impairment of liver function, because normal indicators of liver status, so you can go and get your liver enzymes checked, like ALT, you know, there's a few other markers, GGT, gamma glutamyl transpeptidase, serum glutamate pyruvate transaminase. So there's a few markers for liver function that, when elevated, are indicating that the liver is being damaged. And you can have your normal liver markers, but if you have these tiny little gallstones that over time, as the cells of the liver secrete bile with the toxins in it and you know, just bile for the digestive processes, these tiny stones that are stuck in the bile ducts of the liver, they become bigger ones. And over time, they can grow to, some of them can be as big as your thumbnail in terms of diameter. And this is why it's sluggish, because there's bile being created by liver cells all through the liver, but it's not getting through because the way is impeded. There's a snowballing gallstone that gets bigger and bigger over time. And this is why then you produce less bile, and then it's more difficult to digest food. And that's why a lot of women might feel bad eating fatty foods, eating red meat, sort of heavier foods. It's because they're not producing enough bile to digest the fat. And that is why a lot of people nowadays have more and more small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, SIBO, and small intestinal bacterial small intestinal fungal overgrowth, or CFO, because bile is also has this antifungal, antibacterial effect. So that the less of it gets into or circulates through the small intestine, obviously the more the issue will be exacerbated, right? So estrogen excess is a big issue. And this cholestasis stasis of the bile, maybe this is from the textbook of natural medicine, by the way. Maybe the presence of cholestasis may be a predisposing factor in PMS. And I'm going to do a whole separate episode on PMS. So if you're listening or watching in the future, there will be somewhere on the podcast or on the website, there will be me diving deeper into PMS and things you can do to improve PMS, okay? So the presence of cholestasis, bile stasis, may be a predisposing factor in PMS, because with cholestasis, there is reduced estrogen detoxification and clearance. So this is what another thing I try to kind of paint a picture to my female clients. So a lot of the PMS stuff, that's an estrogen excess issue. A lot of the irritability, sleep issues, various sort of, it could be weight gain, various nebulous health issues or specific health issues, headaches, water retention. A lot of the time it's because of a estrogen excess, or rather a relative estrogen dominance. And the big reason, a big reason can be too much xenoestrogens, phytoestrogens, but a big reason could also be diminished detoxification and clearance, which could be because of the gallstones impeding liver function. It could be because you're not eating enough protein. It could be because you're not getting enough B vitamins. So there's a lot of seemingly unrelated things that need to be optimized. And it's also the beauty of, this is why I kind of love working with women, is because we do a lot of things. We just improve a lot of different things, like nutrient density of foods, stress reduction, eating the right carbs, more protein, the right fats, removing crap out of the diet, and so on. So a lot of these things indirectly and directly support so many different things that it's just a beautiful symphony that occurs, right? So you think you're eating more protein because, you know, it will help you maintain muscle mass as you age, right? And it's whatever, but it's actually supporting detoxification. And when you're supporting detoxification, because there's more amino acids coming from the diet to create detoxification enzymes, then you are supporting estrogen excretion more. And when you support estrogen excretion more, then you are directly improving the progesterone and estrogen ratio. When you do that, your things like PMS can improve. You know, all the things related to estrogen dominance, which we can discuss in another whole episode. But this is where kind of to create truly lasting health transformation and long lasting longevity, vitality, all that good stuff, we need to get all of our ducks in a row. That's why I really like to work with women that are ready to do the work, because there is quite a lot of work to be done. It's not just about getting a few supplements, maybe running a lab test and doing a gut cleanse. It's work. You have to be ready. You have to really want to invest in yourself, and that will require resources, time, and dedication, really, and a little bit of willpower as well. But once you start getting good results, the rewards you get from feeling better, you know, it's gonna feed into so you won't need willpower. It will be drawn. You won't be pushing yourself to do these things, but you'll be drawn to doing them because you feel better and better by improving a bunch of these things. Okay. Oh my God, 36 minutes. All right. So I'm gonna do a little bit more here, and then I'll stop to let you digest it, and then we'll continue with part two. So the detoxification of estrogen. Again, because estrogen is actually toxic in higher amounts, the body has a lot of different ways of detoxifying it. It's very important for it to be detoxified. So this is why I believe, obviously, adding estrogen, like from drugs, toxic chemicals, is a terrible idea. But this is another reason why phytoestrogens, they're touted as so amazing, is a terrible idea. It's why would you want to add more estrogenic things in an already estrogenic environment with the BPAs and the plastics and all the other stuff? That is lunacy. I believe, these phytoestrogens. So anyway, we have the three detoxification pathways are hydroxylation, methylation, and glucuronidation. What do you need to know here? So you don't need to understand a lot of the nitty-gritty here, but basically this is those three pathways I was talking about. So we have the 2-OH pathway, that metabolite, so it kind of gets transformed, and it's called the 2-OH metabolite. That is has very weak estrogenic activity. So it's that is the one term, the good estrogen, in terms of it's the least bad estrogen, I would say. And then you have the 4-OH and the 16A alpha OH. So 2, 4, and 16. So the 2 is generally okay if you're dominant down that pathway. And this is the Dutch test can really tell us which pathways are being favored. Then the 4-OH has a persistent estrogenic activity and can promote tissue proliferation. And anytime you hear promote tissue proliferation, think potential for cancer, because that's cancer is tissue proliferating, cells proliferating without differentiating. And this is kind of where we go back to, is estrogen really the pro-differentiation hormone, or is it progesterone and the other ones that I mentioned, the androgens? So anyway, that's still up for debate. But the 16A or the 16 alpha OH pathway, that's still not great. So if these are not properly detoxed, they basically remain in the body and they can cause havoc, right? So we have to think how can we create an environment for these harmful metabolites to be gotten rid of, neutralized and gotten rid of, right? Or not neutralized, but transformed and then glucuronidized or methylated and et cetera, and then just removed from the body. So what do we need to do? We need to have the liver functioning well, not sluggish, so not blocked up with gallstones and so on. We need to eat enough protein for the amino acids that are required for some of these detoxification enzymes. We need to get the cofactors the various B vitamins and so on, and minerals that are required for detoxification and transformation of toxins, and the estrogen being one of them. And the, you know, these are kind of the main things, right? So the other pathway is methylation. So this is where some women have single nucleotide polymorphisms or SNPs in certain genes, which the gene is used to create the enzyme that is involved in some aspect of inactivating or transforming a compound, toxin, and so on. So the big one here is the COMT enzyme. A lot of people have heard about that one. That's the catechol O methyltransferase. So this enzyme requires a compound called S-adenosylmethionine, or SAM, which is going to provide the methyl group that is attached to the estrogen to create the next compound. And it's also dependent on magnesium as a cofactor. And wouldn't you know it, most people's diets are deficient. And most women are not getting enough magnesium on a daily basis, and that's going to cause a lot of problems. So this, again, we're going back to very simple things that we do with my clients, getting calcium, because most women don't get enough calcium. But then you need to get magnesium. And then, I've mentioned this before, you know, about, I think in the osteoporosis chapter, then you need vitamin D to help with the absorption of the calcium. Then you need vitamin K to make sure that calcium goes to the right places and doesn't cause soft tissue calcification. And then you need to balance all the fat soluble vitamins, and don't forget the protein, and then the carbs. And so it's, you really need to learn what to do, a bunch of different simple things, how to do them correctly, and then continue doing them for the rest of your life. That it's really that simple. I'm not saying it's easy, but if you can learn the right things to do in terms of the nutrients to get, what to eat, what not to eat, how to exercise, how to avoid stress, how to mitigate stress if it occurs, toxins, all that good stuff, right? Once you figure it out, just have to keep doing it and make sure those habits don't deteriorate over time. If you can do that, that is the secret sauce, right? So magnesium. Here's the thing about the COMT enzyme, catechol O methyltransferase. A lot of people, a substantial amount of the population, I don't know the stats, have the polymorphism in the enzyme, as I mentioned. So it can actually be slow, the enzyme activity, I think. So let me just, there's a genetic test, there's a number of different genetic tests that we can run on clients. And this COMT gene is featured in a lot of them because it's such a big player, right? So the gene SNP is when one or both of them are different. Basically, a specific amino acid or sequence in the gene is different from the optimal. Anyway, I won't get into it now. But anyway, if it's one of the two are the suboptimal variant, let's just call it to keep it simple, that is associated with a 3 to 4-fold reduction in the methylation activity of that enzyme, the COMT enzyme. So if you, my enzyme is working fine. The gene is the wild type, as it's known. But my wife has the AG type, which is where you see this 3 to 4-fold reduction in the methylation activity of the COMT enzyme, right? So that means people there's many of them out there, probably in the double digits of the population. It could be in the decent, like 20, 30%, that kind of thing. They will have, the enzyme will be working more slowly, let's say, or less efficiently. It will be basically detoxifying less estrogen, to put it simply, and less things are going to to be methylated, which means things that need to be methylated to be detoxified, this will happen less. But also other things that the enzyme can degrade that are good, there'll be more of. So there's always a bit of a trade-off. It's never only bad, right? So for example, my COMT enzyme, I have the wild type gene, so the enzyme is fast, quote unquote. But that can mean I can plow through my dopamine, inactivate a bunch of dopamine, and then that predisposes me to dopamine-seeking activities, which is why I have always had this addictive tendency. So folks like me with this genotype are more addiction-prone, right? But then folks with like the one my wife has, which is where the enzyme is 3 to 4-fold less quote unquote efficient, then they can be prone to, I don't want to say risk for breast cancer. I haven't dug deeper in there, but they can be more prone to ruminating on things, right? So there's always a trade-off. And we can test for some of these genes that are involved in estrogen detox and stuff like that. The gene tests are pretty good in terms of the company. They don't share the data with other vendors. They destroy the sample after I think 3 months. They don't do other testing. So in terms of privacy and all that stuff, I like them. But their reports in terms of the recommendations are pretty terrible. Like they literally will recommend things like resveratrol or phytoestrogens in the diet because of a specific polymorphism that is on your test. So they'll recommend soy and legumes and alfalfa and clover, and it's just bad. Just the reports, the auto-generated recommendations are fucking terrible, to be perfectly honest. But the actual genetic testing side of things, I really like them. So I do run them once in a while on clients. They have a good test for women that want to get pregnant. It's called the Grow Baby, which we can, there's quite a lot of genes on there, but the most important is the methylation genes, because these are, knowing these means for life, you will know what to do to mitigate risks that exist in your specific set of polymorphisms, right? Sorry, I got off track there a little bit. So that's methylation. And then we have another detoxification pathway for estrogens, which is glucuronidation. And that's bound to the estrogen. And then, of course, it goes through the bile, and then it goes into the small intestine. The idea here, remember, is for the bile to become part of the poop, and then you poop it out. That's a detoxification pathway. But here's the problem. Certain bacteria in the gut, mostly pathogenic bacteria, they have this enzyme called beta-glucuronidase. And beta-glucuronidase basically uncouples the bond between the estrogen and the glucuronic acid. And that can happen in the large intestine. And that can allow estrogen to re-enter circulation. And in fact, at least one study has seen that excess beta-glucuronidase activity is associated with an increased cancer risk, including breast cancer. And what's nice is the GI MAPS2 test that I run on some of my clients can test for beta-glucuronidase. So we can test for pathogenic organisms and all that, you know, worms, bacteria, protozoa, stuff like that. But there's also a few intestinal health markers that can indicate things like this. So it's a really awesome test. I think, okay, 49 minutes. I expected to do less than an hour on this one. So I'll pause it here, take a breather, let you digest this. And then there'll be a second episode that kind of goes a little bit deeper on some of these topics. But I hope you found this useful. And just keep in mind, if you need help with your health journey, you can go to my website to schedule a free intro call with me to see if we're a good fit to work together, see how I can help you and all that good stuff. Yeah, thanks for watching, and I'll see you on the next episode.